Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, December 12th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. So just under a couple of weeks ago, I had the honor of moderating an incredible panel at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. It was the Paramount Science Summit, and it featured Michio Kaku, Brian Greene, and Jim Gates all talking about string theory. And I'm honored to be able to share that with you tonight. But before we dive into that, a little bit of housekeeping. I have some new supporters of the show. Now, remember, I say it each week. I'm going to say it again. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that is mostly because of listeners like yourself who have decided to support the show. One of the main ways you can do it is through Patreon by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. And this week we have some new supporters, including Mark Hepburn, Christian Jeffrey, and David Lacer. Thank you guys so very much. Now that's in addition to some familiar names, which are Phil Tebear, Timothy Glover, Jeffrey Perez, Ron K. Noblock, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, the Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Guys, I couldn't do without you, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart, along with all of the other listeners of the show. Remember, if you want to support the show, you can visit carasantamaria.com and click through to all the many ways that you can, including the Patreon portal, but also by visiting the Talk Nerdy store, where we have t-shirts, handmade mugs, leather goods like keychains and bookmarks, and of course, Charlie and the Tortoise, the Tiny Thinkers book that I wrote the foreword to. We only have a few copies of those left. They're signed by me. And if you use the offer code CHARLIE, you'll get 10% off up through the holidays. Oh, and the very last thing I wanted to mention, don't forget about my partnership this holiday season with GeekWrapped.com. If you visit GeekWrapped.com/talknerdy, you will see a curated gift guide that I've come up with, along with a giveaway for a really, really cool prize. There's only 1 week left in that giveaway, so be sure to visit GeekWrapped.com/talknerdy. Okay, guys, it's a longer than usual episode. The quality is a little different than what you're used to because it is a live show on stage, so you can hear the audience. But I'm so thrilled and honored to be able to bring that live show here to you on the podcast. So I'm going to say it without any further ado. Here they are, Drs. Michio Kaku, Brian Greene, and Jim Gates.
Is everyone excited to be here at the Paramount Science Summit? I'm really thrilled about this evening, and I want to jump right into it by announcing our three guests. So if you guys could come on out here, Dr. Michio Kaku, Dr. Brian Greene, and Dr. Jim Gates. Obviously, these gentlemen really need no introduction, but let me give you a little bit of background. Dr. Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist and a popularizer of science, like all of the gentlemen up here. He's a co-founder of string field theory, which we will be diving into here in a bit. He's also the author of several best-selling books on physics and futurism. His most recent one, which crossed paths with my field, is The Future of the Mind. Let's give him a round of applause. Dr. Brian Greene is a theoretical physicist at Columbia University. He focuses on superstring theory, and he brings science to the public in a lot of different ways through television, 2 NOVA specials, 3 best-selling books, and the annual World Science Festival in New York City, which he co-founded. And And lastly, Dr. Jim Gates, also a theoretical physicist. I think we're seeing a trend here. He's got a special interest in supersymmetry and supergravity, and he currently works as the Regents Professor of the University of Maryland System. So Jim, if I may be so formal, informal, I would love to start with you by asking you a really fundamental question, which really is, why is physics so important? Why is it so fundamental to our understanding of reality, of the universe?
Sure. So, you know, physics is a very interesting endeavor. I always like to give people pictures to think about. And so if you went into a painter's studio, you would see perhaps a painter painting a portrait of someone. And he would be looking at the person, but then on the canvas would be the picture appearing. And you see, that's what we physicists actually do. We look at nature, but on the canvas, we actually paint a representation of nature. But our painting is done in mathematics. This is something that Galileo sort of first talked about in the 16th century, that for physics, mathematics is the language of nature. It's the only one of the human languages that is capable of doing that. So that's what we do. Now, what's the benefit of that? Well, sometimes if you paint a picture really, really carefully and go back and look at it, you will see things that you missed as you were looking at the actual subject. And that's how physics derives its power. It has, because of this mathematical language, the ability for us to look at the math and see things that we didn't know were there in nature. Albert Einstein did this. Most people don't know that he was the first person to figure out how big an atom was, but he did it by looking at the picture and the mathematics.
So do you all consider yourselves mathematicians in addition to being physicists, since it's so important to speak that language to do the work that you do?
Well, not only are we mathematicians, but we're also inventors. People come up to me and say, "What has quantum physics done for me lately, huh?" Well, we invented the transistor. We invented the laser. We wrote the World Wide Web. Don't forget, we also invented television, radio, microwaves, radar, owe the origins to the work of physicists. In the hospital, the
Even
X-ray
Duck
machine.
Even Duck Dynasty, that's physics.
Yeah. Couldn't have that without physics. Right.
In fact, we physicists invented or were at the beginnings of most of the inventions of the 20th century. And now we are inventing the 21st century. So what do? We invent civilization.
So Brian, we were talking a little bit backstage about what young people now are learning in physics. When I was a student and I was taking physical sciences in, you know, elementary or middle school, we mostly focused on classical Newtonian physics. But obviously we now know that physics, and we have known for some time, that physics is so much more than that. So I would love to, this is really asking a lot, get maybe a little lesson, kind of a precursor to diving into some of the more exotic physics that you guys focus on, of the differences between this classical physics and then, of course, general relativity, and moving on to quantum mechanics.
We did have 2.5 hours,
yeah, I heard,
in the introduction, yeah. Which is good. So first, I would quickly say that general relativity is actually a part of classical physics from the perspective of a quantum physicist, in that it makes use of the same kind of concepts that Isaac Newton imagined would be relevant to describing reality. So when you're painting nature using mathematics, as Jim was saying, the math would describe where things are, their position. It would describe their speed, how quickly they are moving. It would describe forces acting on the ingredients to figure out how they will subsequently move. So reality, ultimately, in the classical perspective, is all about trajectories. Particles make up everything, and how they move is a description of reality. And given that data, you're done. In principle, you know how the universe works. The main new idea that came with quantum physics is that this conception of what constitutes reality was approximate, not actually fully correct. And what it was missing, according to quantum physics, is that you can't actually predict with the kind of 100% certainty that Isaac Newton thought you could predict how things will unfold. The best you can do according to quantum physics is predict the probability that this will happen or that will happen, that the electron is here, that the electron is there, that you go left or you go right. And that injection of probability at a fundamental level into our description of reality was completely unanticipated, but carrying out that artistic work in the language of mathematics using data in the 1920s, 1930s, convinced a generation of scientists that we had to move in this direction, because when we tried to describe the newly emerging realm of small things, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, when we tried to use the ideas that worked fantastically well on everyday scales, where Newton focused, we found that they made wrong predictions. They predicted that every single atom in the universe should self-destruct in a fraction of a second. It doesn't happen, and we're kind of happy that it doesn't happen. Yeah. But that made clear that we needed these new laws, and those are the laws of quantum physics.
Isn't it interesting how every branch of science really evolves, oftentimes as a function of the available technology? And of course, the science itself iterates that technology, but without having resolution, without being able to measure things on a small scale, why would you ever think that there would be any sort of wacky quantum things happening when it does get to be so little? But the interesting thing is, as string theorists, things get a little wackier, don't they?
Yes. First of all, things usually happen because of a question, a question that even children can ask. A 16-year-old boy asked himself a question: can I outrace a light beam? It took him 10 years to solve that problem. And when he solved it, he changed world history. That 16-year-old boy was Albert Einstein. A simple question that children ask. Another question is, why does the stars shine? Why does the sun shine? Children ask that question. To answer that question, you have to get into E equals MC squared and nuclear physics. Another simple question is, why do things get red hot, like lava from a volcano? Why does it get red? That led to the birth of quantum physics, the fact that energy can be quantized in little packets. But then you ask yet another question: is a dot the smallest particle? What is the smallest thing? Children ask that question, right? We used to think it was a dot. Not anymore. We're not positive, we can't prove it, but we think it's a vibrating string. And each note on the vibrating string corresponds to a particle. That's why we have so many particles. So physics is nothing but the harmonies you can make on vibrating strings. Chemistry is the melodies you can play on interacting strings. The universe is a symphony of strings. And then the mind of God that Albert Einstein wrote about prolifically for the last 30 years of his life, the mind of God might be cosmic music resonating through hyperspace.
It's very poetic, isn't it? Who knew? You know, I think this is a good segue into the common thread that we see here on this stage, which is string theory. And obviously, some of these concepts are going to be difficult to grasp without having a fundamental understanding of basic physics. Also, not speaking the language of mathematics makes it so that as an audience member or as somebody who hasn't focused their life's work on physics, it makes it so even though we might be able to understand certain things conceptually, sometimes it's difficult for us to actually speak that language along with you. But we're going to try. And I think the first thing that I would love to ask is that string theory itself is not some sort of alternative to quantum mechanics, is it? It's a complement, because the issue that we're all struggling with is quantum gravity. And is that really what the impetus was for string theory? Is that what it's attempting to really solve?
That's not where it was born.
Okay.
And Michio knows the story very well. String theory was not born as trying to make an attempt to describe gravity. It was born trying to describe nucleons and protons and things.
Don't tell people that. That's a secret.
But this story, I think, is something that the public needs to understand, namely that, you know, people think physicists have this like access to the deep knowledge of the universe. We're just like the rest of you. We're bumbling around. And so we try to do something. And it turns out nature has a surprise. So we were trying as a group to describe protons and neutrons. And we found this interesting piece of mathematics that turned out to be string theory. But at the time, we didn't know that it was trying to tell us about gravity. So we bumble around, and then all of a sudden, it's like a bright light shows up in your face. You say, oops, I was looking at the wrong thing now, And all of a sudden, Einstein's dream of a unified field theory was presented to our generation. Although I have to tell you, string theory has not been universally accepted. You have folks here who might accept it, and maybe on Wednesday I accept it, but Thursday I don't. I'm not completely sure. But there are lots of theoretical physicists who would argue that we are, in fact, not barking up the right tree.
Oh, they go further than that. That's a very polite way of putting it.
Yeah, you know, it does make me wonder, obviously, dedicating your time and your energy and, you know, your lab work. Can I call it lab work when you're doing theoretical physics?
How about our lives?
It's in the mind.
How about dedicating our lives?
Yes, dedicating your lives to a question that may or may not pan out and definitely isn't, you know, fully accepted by the rest of the scientific community. Do you often run up against a lot of resistance? Do you get flack from colleagues who are more in the experimental physics side or even theoretical physicists who don't accept string theory?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case, but the nature of being at the cutting edge is that you don't know if you're right or wrong. So if there's universal acceptance, that means you're not working at the cutting edge, right? So that's what you have to live with if you want to push the frontier. But I think it's good to go back. Jim correctly described the history of how strangely this idea of string theory emerged from an undertaking that wasn't looking for it, but it just sort of grabbed us by the lapels and slapped us in the face. But why do we take it seriously and why do we consider it to be important? And that does go to the question that you initially asked, which is the two main breakthroughs in 20th century physics are the quantum theory that we briefly discussed, but then also the general theory of relativity, which is just as old as this theater, it turns out. It's 101 years old, and it's a theory of the force of gravity, which Einstein came up with this beautiful picture that gravity is associated with warps and curves in the fabric of space and time. Each one of those words requires really unpacking and parsing that we don't have time, but it's a spectacularly novel way of thinking about how the force of gravity works. And it does fantastically well at describing astronomical observations. Undoubtedly a better theory than Newton's. On the other hand, quantum theory, which also does a great job of describing the microrealm, as we discussed, when you try to put gravity and quantum mechanics together, the general theory and quantum mechanics together, they don't work together. Each one claims that the other is wrong. They're these ferocious antagonists. And that's a real problem that anybody, experimentalist theorist, someone who has their own ideas that have nothing to do with string theory, they've got to grapple with that. Because the universe works. The universe doesn't grind to a halt. So our mathematics can't grind to a halt either. Mm-hmm. We do need some unified framework that will put the laws of the big and the small together. And that's what string theory, at least on paper, has accomplished for really the first time. And that's why we take it seriously, and that's why we think it's important.
So if it is such a good candidate or a potential candidate for this grand unified theory, why is it that we can't check that box off quite yet?
Well, first of all, for people who are maybe skeptical of the theory, I have no problems with that. I simply ask them to come up with an alternative. There is no alternative to string theory. That doesn't mean it's right. It just means that all attempts to propose an alternative have been shown to be flawed mathematically or physically.
Not everybody would agree with
exactly.
That. I mean, you have a nice
there are people working on something called loop quantum gravity, and they would be in violent disagreement with the comment that Michio just made. But I agree with Michio that.
Yeah, he's right. You're absolutely right. I just want to lay out a more complete picture.
Exactly. No, but look, the physics community, I mean, we're people. People disagree. We disagree, but I think, like Michio just stated, I see nothing on the horizon that looks more promising than string theory, although it does have a problem. And this problem actually was discussed in Brian's television version of The Elegant Universe when Shelley Glashow got on camera and said, you know, is this physics?
Or philosophy. I ask you.
That's right. And that was his question. Yeah. And he was right. Because at a fundamental sense, if you believe in extra dimensions, which string theory seems to naturally lead to, it turns out there's a philosophical problem involved there. And that's what Shelley was raising. And to my mind, even though I'm a fan of string theory, I don't think those of us who support it have adequately addressed his question.
And is that because, as of today, there is no experimental evidence to support it?
It's two things. That's absolutely correct. There is a very conventional picture of string theory that does go back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, which does envision, as Michio is basically saying, that you've got electrons going around the nucleus with neutrons and protons, you've got quarks inside of neutrons and protons, sort of like a sequence of Russian dolls, you know, particles inside of particles, and that is where the conventional ideas stop, the little dots that Michio is referring to. The new idea of conventional string theory is that inside those little dots there is finer machinery. It's just really tiny, and it's a tiny vibrating filament, and those are the notes that Michio was referring to. Vibrating one way, it's a quark, vibrating a different way, and it's an electron. Everything is united under this new idea of vibrating strings. So it does suggest an experimental test, right? Take an electron, look deeply inside of it, and if you see a vibrating string, that's pretty good evidence that the theory is correct. Yeah. You know, so why haven't we done that is a natural question. And it's an issue of scale. So in the conventional approach to the theory, these strings are about 10 to the minus 35 meters across.
Can I inject here?
Yeah.
Because that's a nice for people who like science, but I like to talk to real people.
Well, you cut me right. Let me give it a shot, and then if you do better, I'll do like Michio. I'll say, hey, do better than that.
Okay. So,
as I was about to say, that's such a fantastically small number that the average person can't wrap their mind around it. So an analogy helps, right? So here's an analogy. If you take an atom and magnify it to be as large as the observable universe, that's a huge scale of magnification, then under that magnification, a string would grow to be the size of an average tree.
Wow.
So a tree is to the observable universe as a string is to an atom, and that makes it hard to see them. Your turn.
Brian, I think I'll pass on that one.
The bottom line is you got to be able to test these theories. And a number of tests have been proposed for string theory.
Okay.
For example, there was a prediction made of higher dimensions. We have the inverse square law of Isaac Newton. We learned that in high school. The further you are from the moon, the intensity of gravity goes down by the inverse square. But why the inverse square? Why not the inverse cube? Why not the inverse quartic or quintic? Because we live in three dimensions. If we lived in four dimensions, then gravity would diminish not by the inverse square, but by the inverse cube. Now, therefore, the question is Newton's laws of gravity valid in this room? Not in outer space. Forget NASA and the space program. In this room, in your living room, when you go home at night, is Newton's laws of gravity exact in your living room? That has never been fully tested, except in Colorado. There was one test in Denver of the inverse square law. It turned out that Newton was still right in Denver, which means there's no parallel universe in Denver.
In Denver, that's good to know.
But it's never been done fully, so that is one way to do it.
Have they ever done that test in Washington, D.C.?
He went there. You mentioned parallel universes, multiple universes, but you specifically said four universes or four dimensions, I'm sorry. And when I think of four dimensions, I think of time. Time is the fourth dimension, and that is something that is relatively well accepted in physics today, right? If I wanted to know where to meet you for dinner, I would need to know your latitude, your longitude, what floor of the hotel I might be meeting you in, and what time it is. If I didn't have all four of those different coordinates, I might show up on the wrong day, I might show up at the wrong place. So I can grasp, in a general sense, this idea of time, right? Another way to look at it, you might have heard people talk about you're in a box, you imagine a box, it's got a ceiling and walls and a floor, but no doors and no windows. How do I get outside of the box using this conception of four dimensions? Oh, it's just a different day, and now I'm outside of the box. It's a way to be able to go through those walls. But you move on to 5, 6, 7, 10, or 11 now, as we think of in some versions of string theory. I've always asked this question, and Brian, I've asked it to you before. You may not remember when I've interviewed you, but I always ask this question to physicists when I have them in my grasp, and that is, can you see or think in multiple dimensions? Do you have some sort of capability that the average Joe does not have?
So what did I say?
You said no, but you know what? Neil deGrasse Tyson said yes, and that I wasn't in his club.
He's such a liar. He would not have said that if I was sitting next to him. No,
you know, I don't always agree with Neil, but I agree with him on this in this instance.
Really? You feel like you can kind of visualize
this
world in a way?
Yeah, it's called mathematics.
With math.
Gotcha.
It's just that simple. Mm-hmm.
When I was a child, growing up outside San Francisco, I used to go to the Japanese tea garden. And I used to spend hours looking at the fish, asking a children's question. What would it be like to be a fish in a small pond? And I realized that the universe would be two-dimensional. I could swim forward, backward, left, right, but the concept of up, up into hyperspace, up into the third dimension was considered preposterous. And then I imagined there was a scientist fish there. And the scientist fish would say, bah, humbug, anytime anyone talked about a mysterious third dimension, right? And then I imagine as a child reaching down and grabbing that scientist fish, lifting the scientist fish into the third dimension, hyperspace. What would he see? He would see beings moving without fins, a new law of physics. Beings breathing without air, without water, a new law of biology. And then I would place the fish back into the pond and wonder how would he explain his trip to the other fish, okay? And so, yes, mathematics is the way that we physicists negotiate these higher dimensions, but can we visualize it in our bones? The answer is no, because of evolution. We evolved to avoid emergencies in three dimensions. Your PC computes in n dimensions easily, but our brain evolved on the third dimension on the planet Earth, and that's why we can only visualize three dimensions. But in mathematics, it's trivial to work in hyperspace.
And, you know, it's such an important concept to really master as a science communicator, because I think one thing, other than the fact that you all work in string theory that's shared amongst you, is that you're incredible communicators of science to the public. And when we start talking about multiple dimensions, or we start talking about the multiverse, or we start talking about black hole cosmology, and these very complicated issues that might make sense mathematically, but are hard to kind of visualize in your bones, as you put it, that's when analogy becomes so incredibly important.
Yeah, but there's something very vital there, though, mm-hmm. because you describing that as something that we do when we communicate to the public. And to tell you the truth, the analogy that Mitra just used in wonderful language is the mathematical analogy that we use, at least I do, in my own work. So, yeah, mathematics allows us to talk about n dimensions, but I can't see it in my brain, so I constantly take the problem that is in a higher dimensional realm that I can't picture, I translate it into a lower dimensional version that I can see and play with and manipulate, and then I try to think about what aspects of the higher dimensional problem got lost in that translation, which generalizations can I bring back to the higher dimensional setting to try to inform an intuition that is hidebound to three dimensions, as Mitra said, because of evolution. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that there may be individuals, rare individuals in our species, who really can see higher dimensions. It is not Neil Tyson, as far as I know. But I just give you one example.
Maybe he's an alien.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a mathematician at Princeton. There's a famous story with Thurston. He was teaching a class, right? And he's teaching them six-dimensional geometry and all sorts of stuff. And he's looking at the faces that look kind of blank. They're not really getting it. He walks over to the corner. He's trying to think, why aren't they getting it? He's thinking about it. He comes back. He goes to the class. I understand why you're all confused. It's so much easier to picture this in 12 dimensions. So there are people, I think, mm-hmm. who may be able to break free of the evolutionary trend to only be able to think in three dimensions, but it's rare.
But are they those fish who went on that wonderful trip
there
and still can't really describe it to the
I
other fish?
But I think Einstein, who I like to call my hero Maximus of physics, mm-hmm. said something that's related to this in a very interesting way. So, you know, you're wrestling with this idea, how to see in extra dimensions. Well, in my own work, I've recently tackled that problem in a way that's kind of interesting, I think, to a number of people, including mathematicians. Namely, suppose I had a box, right? You can all imagine a box here, and then let's say it's transparent. I could shine a light through it. And then I see the shadow on the floor. Now, you know, nothing's unusual about that, but suppose the box that I'm imagining is in 14 dimensions. How do I actually show that thing? Well, one thing that you could do is you say each direction is a different color. And so one of the great things about this construct, and as I said, I've actually recently used this to develop some new mathematical ideas, but the thing that's really interesting about this idea, about this, is that it's art that was the access. Mm-hmm. And Einstein, in fact, once said that at the highest levels, art and science are the same in plasticity, aesthetics, and forms. And he said, the greatest scientists are also among our greatest artists.
And some of the greatest artists are interested in mathematics and physics, like Salvador Dali. If you've seen the work of Salvador Dali, you realize he was fascinated by the fourth dimension. Hypercubicus crucifixion. Jesus Christ is crucified in the fourth dimension on a tesseract, which is an unraveled four-dimensional hypercube. And the melted clocks. The melted clocks of Salvador Dali was an attempt to represent time. Mm-hmm. Time on a canvas. How do you represent time as a fourth dimension on a canvas, but a melted clock does everything right there? And even cubism that Picasso helped to formulate has its roots in the geometries of higher dimensions as well. Because if you're looking down from hyperspace, that is outside the pond, looking at the fish, you see the fish in all angles. You see the front, back, side of the fish simultaneously. But when two fish meet each other, they only see the eye or the fin. So if you look down on a woman from hyperspace, you see the nose, face, and ears simultaneously. And what is that called? Cubism.
Interesting. You know, I think it's such an important thing to remember, because you talk to many young people, and there are a lot of young people in the audience right now. Actually, I know you're a little shy, but let me hear it if you guys are like under 21 out there. Yeah. And I hear oftentimes, especially in kind of the tween years, that there's this dichotomy, this false dichotomy between, oh, well, I can either be scientific or I can go into something creative, which to me is insane, because science is one of the most creative endeavors you can possibly endeavor to do. And especially when we start talking about these concepts that are very difficult to conceptualize without the use of mathematics. So we've been talking about multiple dimensions. When we talk about multiple universes, how do those things relate? What is the multiverse, and why is it something that I think most people should at least be aware of conceptually?
Well, Einstein gives us this picture that our universe is a bubble of some sort. Mm-hmm. We live on the skin of the bubble, and we're trapped like flies on flypaper on this gigantic bubble. And the bubble's expanding. That's called the Big Bang Theory. But the new wrinkle in all this is we think there are other bubbles out there, other bubble universes, bubbles that could collide, perhaps, with other universes, universes which can bud and giving what Stephen Hawking calls baby universes. And so the new paradigm is a bubble bath. So next time you take a bubble bath tonight, you may be looking at the universe from a godlike point of view, looking down on smaller dimensional universes. You are sitting in 11-dimensional hyperspace, looking down on all these bubbles that are colliding, reforming, budding. And we even have some experimental hints of experimental evidence. The latest theory of cosmology is called inflation, proposed by a colleague of mine, Alan Guth at MIT. Inflation says there was this turbocharged expansion at the beginning of time, but it was a quantum event, meaning there's a probability it could happen again and again and again. So big bangs may have happened even as we began this lecture, meaning that our universe could be budding baby universes out there. And then the next question you're going to ask me is Elvis Presley still alive in another one of these parallel universes? That cannot be ruled out.
My next question was actually going to be about the experimental evidence that could exist. You know, when we think about our own universe and we think of kind of our cosmology, we think about the Big Bang that we now understand, we think about inflation, we think about ways that we can actually look into the past, one of which being the cosmic microwave background radiation. You guys have all seen this kind of illustrated as a globe almost, and you can see all of that data that we believe came back to, not exactly the Big Bang, but starting how soon?
380,000 years after the Big Bang.
380,000 years after the Big Bang. If we had at any point in time collided with another universe, would there be a pattern that would be recognizable on that CMB?
In principle, yes, and that's what makes this an experimental subject as opposed to just philosophical ideas. So if two universes were to collide, if two of those bubbles in the cosmic bubble bath hit each other, the reverberation from the collision would create a certain kind of circular-like pattern in the microwave background radiation. But nobody has seen this, but it doesn't mean that it's not there. Just maybe it's at a level that's too small for us to detect with their ability so far. But I do think it's worth also just noting, much as we did with string theory, there is a great deal of skepticism about these multiverse ideas. Right. Calling it the new paradigm is a certain perspective, mm-hmm. and it's one that I have a certain amount of sympathy with, and that I have an open mind to this as a possibility. But there are others who claim that any theory, like inflationary cosmology, which predicts that there can be universe after universe after universe, necessarily undercuts its own support. Why? Each of these universes, you can show mathematically, will have different forms of the microwave background radiation, different forms of physics, which means any prediction that you make will be borne out in one of those universes. So there's no way to prove in a theory like that wrong without something else coming from the outside and saying, oh, even though there are all these possible universes, only these are the ones that really are the ones that are worthy of your attention, because mathematically the others happen so rarely that you don't even need to think about them. And we don't have any statement like that mathematically. So there's a whole community of physicists, serious physicists. In fact, one of those physicists is the co-founder of inflationary cosmology with Alan Guth at MIT. So Paul Steinhardt at Princeton, who wrote one of the very first papers on inflationary cosmology, has now disowned that theory.
That's right.
Because of the fact that mathematically it predicts all of these other universes, which to his mind makes it no longer a predictive framework. I think that's going too far. I think that we should right now hover in the middle space and say this is a fantastically interesting possibility that there might be other universes. It naturally fits into the progression of ideas that go back all the way to Copernicus. There's a time when we thought we were the center of everything here on Earth, right? And then we learned, no, 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 we go around the sun. We thought the sun was the center of everything. Oh, but then we learned the sun is one of hundreds of billions of stars in the galaxy. We figure, oh, the galaxy, that's it. No, then we learn that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe. A cosmic demotion happening over and over again, the natural next step is that we are not the only universe. So it sort of fits in very nicely with that kind of progression. So I don't think we should discount it. Naturally, it arises from the mathematics. But no way can we really say that this idea, as it's formulated today, has enough weight, enough power, enough mathematical power behind it to say that this is sort of a done deal. This is how the world works.
And so Elvis could be alive after all.
But he probably has a bizarro mustache.
No, but I think that...
Let me say, so if these ideas are correct, just because that's, you know, as a serious statement, actually. If these ideas are correct, then you can mathematically prove that there is a universe where Elvis still exists. Because you can prove that any configuration of particles compatible with the laws of physics will be realized somewhere, and Elvis is just a configuration of particles, right? So he's out there somewhere, and in fact, the very first time that I spoke about these ideas, I wrote a book that touched on these things. I gave a talk at a Barnes & Noble, and I'll date myself by this particular very quick story. So there's a woman in the front row. She says, wait, so she wasn't focused on Elvis. She said, wait, if you're telling me that there could be other universes out there where the configuration of particles is a little different from here, does that mean there's a universe where Sarah Palin is president? She said. So I was like, I didn't really know what to say. I'm not like a particularly like political person. And so luckily a guy in the back of the hall raised his hand and said, didn't you hear what the professor said? The configuration of particles must be compatible with the laws of physics.
But for the audience, I think it's very important for our audience who are participants in this discussion to understand that what you're seeing here on the stage is what physicists do. Mm-hmm. We argue all the time, like the siblings in a family, you know, no, I'm going to get that, no, it's mine, right? Don't get close to me, don't touch me, right? That's who we are. We are a community that debates endlessly the possibilities with the idea that we're going to distill the best mathematics to fit the observations. And so when Michio said a new paradigm has emerged, there is a group of physicists who would agree with that. But I think quite rightly, as Brian spoke a few moments ago, you know, I always like to tell people, physicists will change your minds at the drop of a fact.
What a great phrase.
And so that's something you really need to keep in mind about us.
I love that. Oh, yes, of course.
Steve Weinberg, Nobel Prize winner at University of Texas, has a very nice example of trying to explain this by listening to a radio. If you have a radio in your living room, you're tuned to all sorts of frequencies. You can pick up frequencies from Beijing, Moscow, Washington, all hundreds of frequencies you can pick up on your radio in your living room, but you're only tuned to one frequency that you hear. Now, in your same living room, you have the wave functions. The wave functions of particles in different configurations. The wave functions of universes where dinosaurs still exist. Wave functions of universes where there are pirates in the room, where the Earth never formed, where dinosaurs still roam the Earth. These wave functions can exist in your living room simultaneously, but you are only tuned to one frequency. And the frequency that you are tuned to is what is called reality. And this is where Einstein departs from Newton. Newton would say that reality means there's only one frequency. There is only one frequency on that radio. The quantum theory says no. In principle, there are an infinite number of frequencies, and you can calculate. Calculate the probability you can move between universes. You do what is called the WKB approximation. It's a tunneling effect. You would have to wait longer than the lifetime of the universe to meet Elvis Presley. But that doesn't mean you can't do it, okay? So it's kind of unnerving, because in some sense it means that people who died, loved ones who died, in some sense are still alive, except they're vibrating at a different frequency, and we've decoupled. We have decoupled from these other frequencies, so we cannot enter their world. But this is how we physicists view the difference between quantum theory and classical theory. Newton says there's one station that your radio is tuned to. The quantum theory says, no, in your room, in your very living room, there's a wave function of dinosaurs, pirates, asteroids. It's all there. You've just decoupled from them.
It makes me... This leads me, I think, to a question that I struggle with. As a science communicator, as somebody who, you know, ventures to learn as much as I possibly can about reality, but also as a self-described atheist, as an individual who is part of the skeptical community, as somebody who finds that it's very important to separate reality from propaganda, to separate reality from what we like to call woo in the skeptic community. And I would love to hear your take on what we sometimes see as a movement to use these ideas of quantum mechanics or use these principles in physics and apply them to areas where they maybe shouldn't be applied or utilize them to put forward a narrative that is not really a responsible narrative within the scientific community.
Can I say a few words?
Yeah. I think everyone is going to have something to say about this. Yeah.
We'll go at the same time and see what happens.
Just one quick thought and then I'll defer to Jim on that. So, quantum mechanics, as we've heard, has been very powerful not only in describing data, but in allowing us to build things. So we feel like we have some grip on what quantum mechanics is. The cell phone that Jim's about to pull, I'm not even looking.
He already did.
But it's important to bear in mind that there are key questions at the heart of quantum mechanics that we do not know the answer to today. And one of those questions speaks directly to the description that Michio was given. It's called the quantum measurement problem. And the weirdness of quantum mechanics, as we briefly reviewed at the outset, is that it predicts probabilities for this, that, or the other thing. Whenever we look at the world, though, we don't see probabilities. We see one definite outcome. We don't see the electron sort of here, sort of here. I don't see you partly there, partly there. When I look at you, I see you 100% sitting over there. So the question is, how do we go from the fuzzy probabilistic description of reality that the math of quantum mechanics gives us to the single definite reality that we all experience when we actually look out at the world? Mm-hmm. We do not know the answer to that question today. So many people have put forward proposals That might be answers to that question. One of those proposals aligns with the description that Mitra has given. It's called the Many Worlds Interpretation. It goes back to 1957, Hugh Everett III at Princeton University. Very interesting idea. There are other proposals, though, for solving this measurement problem, which don't involve those ideas of other worlds and other possibilities. Much more straightforward possible solutions where what you see is what you get. There's one definite reality, and there are definite ways in which this realm of many possibilities comes together and gives you one reality. And that is it. It's a far less far-reaching change to our philosophical perspective, but nevertheless, it could well be the answer. As of today, we don't know which is right. So it's dangerous to invest any one given interpretation of quantum mechanics with too much metaphysical weight, because it simply may be incorrect. So when you talk about taking quantum mechanics and using it to talk about a whole host of things, I can't tell you the number of letters that we all get from people who are using quantum mechanics to describe everything from ESP to alien life to talking to past gone relatives. Most of those applications are dead wrong. And the ones that aren't dead wrong, that may fit into the gray area, we don't know if they're right or they're wrong. So what I'm trying to say is none of the weirdness of the sort that you're describing has any basis in our current understanding of reality. That doesn't say quantum mechanics doesn't have fantastically weird properties that are more thrilling to a physicist than those. I'll give you one quick one, quantum entanglement. That's this idea that Einstein came up with two colleagues in 1935, which says you can have an object over here and another over there that in some sense, in some quantum mechanical way, talk to each other instantaneously. They could be thousands of miles apart, millions of light years apart. You do something to this fella and it affects the one over here instantaneously. Einstein called it spooky. Spooky action at a distance, right? He thought it was the downfall of quantum mechanics. He thought he found a chink in the armor of quantum mechanics. But long after he departed this world, experiments show that this kind of spooky connection is real. Quantum entanglement is real. And today, people are pushing this idea further, using it in the studies of black holes, the very fabric of space itself. We now think possibly, again, these are cutting-edge ideas, that space-time may be glued together by quantum entanglement between the fundamental ingredients, whatever they are, that build up the fabric of space-time itself. These are thrilling ideas, mathematically based, at the cutting edge of thinking, and they don't have anything to do with your dead Aunt Susan.
And Jim, did you have anything to add?
So I wanted to come back to a slightly different point, because there was a subtext to your question that I often encounter, and I'm sure my colleagues do also, which is that there's this built-in antagonism between faith-based belief systems and science. And what my position is a sort of a middle position, which is that there was a biologist by the name of Stephen Jay Gould, who some of your reader audience... I, too, was an enormous fan. He was a fantastic thinker as well as author. And he talked about this issue of faith versus science. And he said, there's not a conflict. And this is a very old idea, but he called it the non-overlapping magisteria. He said that the realm of faith and the realm of science were non-overlapping magisteria. And I've spent some time thinking about this, and I think I've even discovered mechanisms by which he was right. But let me just give an example of what I think is the abuse of science in order to attack faith. I was on a panel discussion with our good friend Lawrence Krauss at one of the Nobel conferences some years ago. And Lawrence at that time had just finished his book, A Universe from Nothing. And if you read the book, it's really one of the most beautiful, and if I may use the word elegant, descriptions of what we physicists think happened between the time of the Big Bang and how we all got here. And he gave this beautiful lecture about this subject. And then at the end of the lecture, he concluded, on the basis of this science, we no longer need to have a mythology about a creator. And so there was a panel discussion at the end of it, and I was sitting there thinking, as the discussion was going back and forth, and I asked Lawrence two questions after a while. I said, Lawrence, you've just given us this beautiful story where the universe comes from a dynamical quantum fluctuation. He said, yes. And I said, so do you believe that time came into existence when the universe came into existence? And he said, yes. And I said, so how do you get a dynamical fluctuation if there's no time? And the point of the question was that when you try to use science to attack someone's faith, there's a scientific question that can be asked of you that you probably will not be able to answer. And this is about certainty. Mm-hmm. You see, when scientists say we believe something, we actually have a figure of merit. It's called the error bars or the uncertainty. When we state a belief, we also say, this is true up to this degree of our certainty. That's a part of science. So if a scientist says, on the basis of my science, I disbelieve something, you should simply ask, well, what is your uncertainty and your disbelief? Mm. And so science is, in fact, terribly ill-positioned to attack people's faith. That's my position.
And I think it's important to look at the alternative as well. And it's, I think, something that frustrates me quite a bit when I look at conversations about spooky things, like some of the weirdness of quantum mechanics, and string theory, I guess, beyond that, utilizing these ideas to try to describe things like consciousness or to try to describe things like God, for example, where it is, I think, important, and I'm so glad that we're having this conversation here on this stage and that it is kind of being carefully regulated, that we talk about what we know and what we think we know and what we maybe still don't know but are trying to know. Because I think sometimes as consumers of scientific information, we often will put individuals who do the science on a pedestal. You know, it is an appeal to authority because we don't speak the math. And because we don't speak the math, we don't get to check your answers. There is no peer review process in that aspect. And so I do very much appreciate when physicists will tell me ahead of time, you know, this is something that we are working on. We don't have any direct evidence for it, but it seems to be the best theory that we have, or vice versa. You know, in the world of biology where I come from, theory is used in a completely different way. We don't have theories until we have so much evidence to support them. Whereas in physics, when we talk about theory, sometimes we're talking about things that have actually no experimental evidence that supports them, and that's very interesting to me.
Well, I like to quote Galileo, who in turn quoted another person, and he said that the purpose of science is to determine how the heavens go. The purpose of religion is to determine how to go to heaven. So, in other words, religion is about ethics. It's about how to be a good person. Science is about natural law. The problem occurs when people in natural law pontificate about ethics or when ethicists begin to pontificate about natural law. That's when we get into trouble, okay? But as long as we keep the two separate, I think we're fine. And then Einstein was asked about God numerous times, and he said very simply, there really are at least two kinds of God. So you have to be careful. You have to separate two different kinds of God. The first is the personal God, the God you pray to, the God that parts the waters, the God that smites the Philistines, the personal God. The other God is the God of Spinoza, the God of harmony, beauty, simplicity, elegance. That universe he could believe in, that God he could believe in, he could not believe in a personal God that smite the Philistines just because you happen to be at war with them. And so I think that's a nice way. So again, religion is about ethics, how to be a good person, how to go to heaven. And as long as we keep that distinction separate from natural law, then I think we're going to be in good shape. And as Steve Weinberg, again, Nobel laureate, has mentioned many times, 1,000 years ago, this very same debate emerged in the Islamic world, that certain Islamic scholars who were studiers of science said that natural law comes from Allah. Other people said, no, Allah can change natural law anytime he feels like. Therefore, why bother to study natural law when Allah can change natural law just like that? And where does truth come from? The book, the Quran. And that began the millennial slide in the Islamic Empire, when the Islamic Empire, which helped to invent optics,
algebra
is an Arabic name, Algol, Altair. They're all Arabic names for the stars. Most of the stars have Arabic names to them. That whole empire began to disintegrate when some scholars said that truth comes from the book, not from natural law.
Yeah, and interestingly, natural law hasn't changed much as we've been observing it now, has it? We might have learned new things about it, but it's been pretty consistent throughout at least the human lifespan. So I think that this is a good point because we're not quite almost done, but we are running low on time, which bums me out a lot, to remind everybody of the partners that helped bring this event here today. So I want you guys to give a big thank you one more time to the University of Texas at Austin Energy Institute. The Environmental Science Institute, the University of Texas at Austin McDonald Observatory, and lastly, the University of Texas at Austin Department of Physics. Thank you guys so much. So I made a little cheat sheet. I have a note card here that I've actually labeled questions of interest. And I think of these as the types of questions that I most often hear and I most often would see in the comment sections when I would write about physics. And they're all really big picture questions, which we literally have only time to scratch the surface of, but I think they're the ones that gnaw at us when we really start thinking about our place in the universe and what it is that we truly understand of the universe. And before I get into the really big picture ones, one that I think especially, well, actually all of you could probably take a crack at is, why is it that when we talk about not just string theory, but quantum mechanics and this interest in putting together a grand unified theory, why are black holes so important to that equation? Why do we keep seeing them discussed over and over?
Well, we think that they're real. There's observational evidence that they're actually out there. And they are the most extreme environment that we have access to. So how does a black hole form? You have a star that collapses under its own weight after it exhausts its nuclear fuel. So there's an incredible amount of mass crushed to a very small size. Now, a lot of mass means gravity matters, so you need Einstein's general relativity, as we were discussing before. When things get really small in length scale and size, you need quantum physics. So here's a domain in which general relativity and quantum physics are forced to come together, right? There are some who would say, well, look, if general relativity works for the big, quantum works for the small, just use general relativity in the big, use quantum in the small, and go home, right? Why bring them together if you don't have to? Black holes force us to bring them together, and therefore it's the natural laboratory that we use in our mathematics.
It's hard to believe that nature could have a left hand and a right hand that don't talk to each other, right? We need a unified theory of our hands. Mm-hmm. And that's what string theory gives us. And black holes, as Brian mentioned, is the link between the small and the very big, where you necessarily have to put in quantum effects in order to explain black holes, which we can see.
Yeah, black holes are in some sense the most elegant objects that we have seen in our physics. These are objects that are infinitesimally small, but they have macroscopic effects. It's, you know, with an electron, everybody's heard about an electron. But, you know, when you drive down the street, you don't worry about the electron that's in the wall. If there was a black hole on the wall, I'd worry about it, right? So this is an extraordinary structure that is something that is elementary, that has macroscopic effects. And we know of nothing else in the realm of physics that fits this description.
And this year marks the 100th anniversary of the founding of black hole physics. Karl Schwarzschild, 1 year after Einstein worked out general relativity, on the Prussian-Russian front, as he was fighting a war, worked out the equations for a black hole. Unfortunately, he died as a consequence of that war, showing you what wars have done to the physics community.
But this is also the 100th year where we got to see gravity waves. LIGO produced for us the first human observation. I like to think of it as the singing of space. Because what happens is, you know, in the back when I was young, we talked about whale song, that whales in the great ocean could produce these tones that would travel tens of thousands of miles so that whales on the other side of the planet would hear the song. Now we are in position as a species to hear the songs that occur when black holes collide and they set this music moving towards the planet Earth. And in fact, it's opened up an incredible, and black hole, to me, it's very elegant, the universe, and I keep borrowing that word from my friend.
I'm going to take some royalties from that. Okay.
It is very elegant to me that we live in a universe where the first observation of gravity waves was tied to black holes. And why is this important? Well, you see, once you know that you can hear the universe, that you can hear space and time creaking, then you can begin to construct the analogs of sonograms. Ultimately, we are going to have something I call sonoastronomy, and it's going to open up. It's just like when Galileo took the first telescope and pointed it up towards the heavens and could see the satellites of Jupiter and the craters on the moon. We're going to live in a time where this new technology opens up for us a way to see not just to that 380,000-year baby picture of the universe that we call the cosmic microwave background. I mean, our universe is so smart, it took its own baby picture. And it's up there right now. If you could see a microwave, you would see that picture. And right now, you can't see anything before that. But with gravity waves and sonoastronomy, we're going to be able to see all the way back to the Big Bang.
Isn't it fascinating? I mean, it just reminds me of what we were talking about earlier, how the technology has to evolve with the theory. And once we're capable of building a machine that's far enough apart, that's static enough to be able to feel those perturbations, that we could observe something, and much quicker than we expected, right? Very soon after it went online, we saw this gravitational wave, this blip.
Yeah, it was in an engineering run 2 days after they turned it on. And, you know, if you think about the actual sequence of events that played out to make that happen, you know, the black holes that Jim is referring to, they're 1.3 billion light years away. And they collided, therefore, 1.3 billion years ago, sending out this tidal wave in the fabric of space, rushing out in all directions, some of it going toward Earth. 100,000 years ago, it reaches the Milky Way galaxy, right? When it's 100 light years away, a guy named Einstein starts to calculate and realize that there could be these gravitational waves, inspiring others to try to build the machine that might actually capture this. When that wave is 2 light days away, okay, they turn on the machine. It rolls by Earth on September 14th and causes the machine to twitch.
It's amazing.
That's how we capture that gravitational wave.
And it makes you think about, exactly. It makes you think about how often gravitational waves are rippling through your body and you have no way to be able to feel it or to measure it. But now that we have this incredibly fine-tuned machinery, we're just going to keep seeing more and more examples.
You know, every time we discover a new type of telescope, it changes religion, it changes psychology, it changes politics. When Galileo turned the telescope to the skies 400 years ago, that challenged the Catholic Church, that challenged our conception of who we are in this universe. Then during World War II, with the creation of radar and radio telescopes, that opened up a whole new realm of astronomy, radio astronomy, where we could peer into galaxies and see quasars. Now is the third generation, where we have telescopes that will not just be on the Earth, but space-based telescopes. We're going to put LIGO into outer space. It's called LISA. The Europeans are working on it. NASA's working on it. And we may be able to even detect vibrations from the instant of the Big Bang, or very close to the instant of the Big Bang. You talked about the cosmic microwave background, right? Mm-hmm. When you turn on your radio at night and you hear a static on your radio, most of that static comes from Jupiter. Jupiter is quite radioactive. That's where a lot of the static comes from. Some of that static comes from Genesis, from the Big Bang itself. You can actually hear, quote unquote, hear the Big Bang on your radio tonight. That means that you're hearing radiation from 380,000 years after the instant of the Big Bang. We want baby pictures of the instant when the infinite universe is emerging from the womb, because maybe then we'll detect an umbilical cord connecting our baby universe to a multiverse.
And gravitational waves may be the answer to that.
Gravitational waves will take us to within a trillionth of a second after the instant of creation. not 380,000 years after creation.
And to be clear, we keep mentioning that time frame, that 380,000 years. The reason that we can't really see anything from before that is because the universe was just simply too opaque. It was simply too dense.
It had charged particles, and light can't travel through a charged medium without getting scattered all over the place.
Too foggy.
It's like in a Turkish steam bath. You know, the light just can't
penetrate. Or imagine going underwater in a pool of milk and turning on a flashlight, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always wonder about that.
We'll go with the Turkish steam bath, I think. But we could potentially measure the perturbation of this incredible
bang. And again, just to keep everything, you know, down to earth, when you talk to the actual gravitational wave folks who succeeded in capturing that first gravitational wave, they are very, very conservative about whether we will be able to capture gravitational waves from the Big Bang. It's not like this is around the corner. I mean, we might get lucky, but there's a good chance that it may be beyond our ability, too. And that, again, is what it means to be at the cutting edge. You don't know.
So let me just respond to that. I was on a program with both Ray and Kip about 3 weeks ago. And this very point came up. And although they are conservative, they are extraordinarily hopeful that they've opened the door for humanity to actually see the beginning of it all.
Yeah.
And we saw, I mean, I think in many ways, we saw a similar opening up of our capabilities when the Large Hadron Collider went online, when we started to see the ability to smash particles at an incredibly quick speed. We had a particle accelerator previous to that, but none that were so large. And so being able to see evidence of the Higgs field, for example, and be able to really confirm what was already well established, or at least well expected, to be able to confirm that was huge.
But that was huge. It was huge also to a string theorist, because I should say, you know, and I know we're nearing the end, but I just want to be out there on the record saying, I am highly skeptical of string theory. So I don't want to leave this with some sense. There's no data now establishing that it's correct, so you have to be skeptical of anything of that sort. But the story of the Higgs is a beautiful one from anyone's perspective, but especially from a string theorist, because the Higgs began as a mathematical idea in 1964. Peter Higgs, walking around trying to figure out how particles gain mass, comes up with this mathematical idea that nobody believed at the time. He goes around, sticks with it. It got rejected, the first paper that he sent to a journal. He stays with it. He ultimately convinces the community that this is an idea that really makes sense, so much so that when I was a graduate student in 1986, learning about the Higgs idea in my particle physics class at Oxford, it was presented as something that was so certain to be correct, I didn't even know it hadn't been confirmed. I thought it had already been confirmed, right? That was 1986. And then you keep going, and people build this amazing machine, the Large Hadron Collider. And then in 2012, they smash particles together, in some sense, spanking the vacuum of space, kicking off a little fleck of this field, which is the Higgs particle, showing that it is actually correct. Mm-hmm. So from mathematics to observation, that's the trajectory, of course, that we hope we're on.
No, but if we did not discover the Higgs boson, if the machine did not discover the Higgs boson, we would have been in deep doo-doo if that happened.
But
the foundation of modern quantum field theory would have crumbled.
Yeah. We'd still
but
be
there's
looking.
A Texas component. There's a Texas component to this story also.
Yeah?
That I think that is incumbent upon us to speak, especially to an audience like
this.
That's
true.
Because although the Higgs boson was discovered at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, we in the United States missed an opportunity. Mm-hmm. There was a plan. There was a plan to build a device called the Superconducting Super Collider. It would have been in Waxahachie, Texas.
Good
okay,
pronunciation.
Okay. But the thing that was interesting is the SSC, as it was called, when it would have opened, which would have been the middle 90s, it would have been three times as powerful as the LHC, which means that we would have found the Higgs particle here in Texas. Not in Geneva, Switzerland. And it didn't happen because our community was not effective in communicating to people like those in the audience what was at stake here. This was a lost opportunity for the United States of America. And, you know, you can lose opportunities so many times and maybe not pay a cost, but if we, as a nation, And this goes back to the point that was alluded to before about the divergence of where science fits relative to faith. If we as a nation lose faith in our ability to pursue science at its extreme limits, at its borders, that will almost certainly signal that we as a nation will have lost something so precious that I simply can't imagine a United States in the future that doesn't remember that there's a future, that there's a frontier out there that fundamentally this country has always dealt with since its birth.
You know, on the near the last day of hearings on the Super Collider, one congressman asked the fatal question which killed the entire project. Quote, "Will we find God with your machine? If so, I will vote for it." The poor physicist who was asked that question didn't know what to say. So he said, "We will find the Higgs boson."
We found the goddamn particle, you guys. We found the goddamn particle.
All the jaws hit the floor of the United States Congress. $10 billion for another goddamn subatomic particle. Now, since then, we physicists have been racking our brains. How should we have answered that question? Now, I would have said this. God, by whatever signs or symbols you ascribe to the deity, this machine, the supercollider, will take us as close as humanly possible to his greatest creation, Genesis. This is a Genesis machine. It'll recreate on a microscopic scale the most glorious event in the history of the universe, its birth. Instead, we said Higgs boson.
No, but this discussion also is a discussion that we in our community must reflect upon, because we have got to be able to speak to the rest of society in an effective manner. And maybe if Dr. Kaku had been there in the Congress talking to this congressman about the possibilities of our, as a species, getting closer to the handiwork of the Creator, that might have made a difference.
So this is all very poetic, but I will say that the reality of what was going on then is a little bit different from what we're talking about here, right?
Some of us know it was the International
Space Station versus the Large Hadron.
Some of us know that story.
In fact, the real issue came down to only one of those could be funded, and they did a better job because astronomy is fundamentally more accessible. It's sort of more sexy. It's something that everybody can look up and feel that sense of wonder and awe.
But that's what
Brian,
gentlemen, it's a difficult thing, right? Because I really support, and maybe this is a good note to end on. I still wanted to ask what happened before the Big Bang, where we're going, what the universe is made of. We didn't get to any of these things. But I do want to open it up to audience questions. But it is important, I think, to find that balance between asking fundamental questions that don't necessarily have an answer when somebody says, how will this affect me personally? And also understanding that the public, who is often funding these endeavors, has a right to know why it matters to them. And they have a right to know why the work that's happening in these kind of hallowed halls of the university buildings where they don't often have access, why it's important for humanity. And it's incumbent on scientists and science communicators like myself, who oftentimes are a liaison between scientists and the public, to communicate those things in a way that is understandable and is actionable. Because if we ignore that responsibility, I think, to everybody who's sitting here, we're not doing a service to society as a whole. And I just think it's an important thing to always, always remember. And I love that the three of you do such an incredible job, which is why you're on the stage right now tonight with us, of communicating the science that you do, the importance of the science that you do, and inspiring a generation of thinkers to want to dive deep into those fundamental questions and to want to understand what our place in the universe really is. So I thank you all for being here tonight and for offering your perspective. And at this point, wonderful applause. At this point, I do want to open it up to just a few questions in the audience. Unfortunately, there are no house microphones. So the way that we'll do it is if you can just kind of raise your hand where you're sitting. You don't have to come up. I'll call on you. Only raise your hand if you have a loud voice. If you feel confident that you can make sure that you're heard. And remember, try to ask a question, try to ask an answerable question. This is not the comment and answer portion. I'm going to repeat your question so that for the recording, everybody can hear it. Go ahead. Are we living in a simulation? Oh,
so,
great. It's easy.
So let me take a crack at that one, because I have to tell you that over the course of the last 10 years or so, some of my research has done some very strange thing to me. And I get this question at least several times a week from someone in the public. So I think the answer is no. And the reason that I think the answer no is sometimes called Occam's razor, namely that you... But the thing that's really weird is if you believe that we live in a simulation, then ghosts are guaranteed to exist. Now, that may sound like a joke, but it's not. You see, if we're in a simulation, that means everything we experience is a program that's running on some kind of apparatus. As long as that apparatus is not damaged, that means you can enable that program at any point in time. And therefore, at some point after I've died, if this super being decides to simply re-engage or re-enable the Jim Gates program, then the Jim Gates, as we are concerned, comes back to life. So if you believe that that's possible, then simulation theory may be attractive to you. I don't think that's an attractive way to think about the universe.
You know, I had the opportunity to interview some scientists who were publishing about this kind of simulation theory, and what they were positing to do was simulate, I think, a femtometer of the known universe, utilizing all of the laws of physics that we know to this point. And that's kind of where that question came from. Well, if we can simulate the universe computationally, what's to say that we are ourselves not living in a simulation? And I was worried that they were going to get really religious on me, and I asked him, worrisomely, well, if we were living in a simulation, who would be the simulator, right? Is that the big guy in the sky? And their answer was, no, it's us, just way off in the future.
But that's the power of the idea. The power of the idea is, to people who think that the idea of a creator necessarily lies outside of the realm of science, mm-hmm. here's a version of that story that's completely within an Uber framework that doesn't have anything supernatural. If we can create simulations with adequate verisimilitude so that beings, which by assumption have consciousness within the simulation, think that the world is real, mm-hmm. then they were created by an actual being who is subject to the laws of physics in that uber world that surrounds everything. So, you know, so the real place where this question comes from, at least fundamentally, is an observation of Nick Bostrom of Oxford. He said, look, if it's possible that there can be sentient beings inside a simulation, we don't know if that's true. Maybe you got to have this gray thing inside your head in order to have consciousness. We don't know. Nobody does. But if it's possible to create consciousness in a computer, right, well, then it's so much easier to create a simulated universe compared to creating a real one. If I challenge you to create a real universe, you're kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. But if we do have that software at some point in the future, you can kick back, flip a switch, and create universe after universe after universe in your computer, well, there are going to be so many simulated universes compared to real ones. So any sentient being, just looking at the laws of probability, will say, it's more likely that I'm in one of those simulations because there's so many, as opposed to that real universe of which there's maybe one. That's where the idea comes from.
Yeah.
I think the answer is no for a more simple reason. First of all, if you use chaos theory, in chaos theory, you try to simulate the weather. And I think most people in chaos theory would say that the smallest object which can simulate the weather is the weather. The weather is the smallest object which can simulate the weather, because computers can't do it. When you talk about the universe, perhaps the smallest object which can simulate the universe is the universe.
Yeah, but you see, you only need to convince a few sentient beings within that simulation, and that's different than having to actually simulate the whole universe. You need to simulate the part of the universe that I happen to be looking at now, or now, or now.
Okay, now.
Which is a much easier problem.
Right, but there are two kinds of simulated universes. One is the universe as a motion picture. That is, God pushes the play button mm-hmm. and simply watches this debate as it proceeds.
Or us in the future.
So, yep. But you see, then that would essentially mean that the future, the past is predetermined because mm-hmm. everything is nothing but a motion picture. Someone hits the play button. The other simulated universe is different. And that's the Matrix. The Matrix in which things look real, but there are sentient beings with consciousness inside yep. that universe. Then you have problems with uncertainty, right? And so then you would have to simulate all possible universes, and that is non-computable. So it is non-computable. No computer can possibly calculate all possible quantum realities if you want to have a real quantum universe. In other words, no.
And I might add to that, as of today, that might not be possible. But for further, I guess, instruction on that question, I would recommend watching Black Mirror, and you might learn quite a bit. All right, I have a question here. Would the M drive qualify as a type 3 impossibility?
Possible. I don't understand every other word
in
that
question, but I don't
understand
what that question is either.
If you understand it, I'm good.
Oh, like the new M drive? You're talking about the new NASA M drive? Okay. We still don't know if that's real. Yeah, we still don't know if that's panning out. So, yeah, this idea, the EM drive.
What is an EM drive?
It's NASA's messing
plasma drive?
It's the new, how can we describe this? It's free energy. I mean, it violates
free energy?
Fundamental right. laws of physics. So I think the question is it a mistake in calculations? I think we still need to replicate this a few more times before anybody probably on this stage
well,
buys
in my book,
it.
The Physics of the Impossible, I give you levels of impossibility. Because mm-hmm. to say that something is impossible means that maybe it's simply improbable or outside of what we know today versus what is outside of physical law as we know it today. So a class 3 impossibility would be something like violating the conservation of matter and energy or something from nothing. Now it turns out that people like Tesla argue that the vacuum contains energy, perhaps we can harness it one day. This is called free energy or the energy of the vacuum. There are zero-point energy. Now, zero-point energy does exist. It's called the Casimir effect, but it's very small, extremely tiny. Even the weight of a single ant can outweigh the energy found in a gigantic free energy machine. So there is such a thing as free energy, except it's useless. You cannot extract large amounts of usable energy from it. However, there is an application for the energy of nothing, and that is we think that's what drives the Big Bang. We think that the Big Bang is driven by dark energy, which is the energy of nothing. And the dark energy is anti-gravitational and makes the universe come apart. And that's why the universe is accelerating out of control at the present time. It's one of the greatest mysteries in all of science. The mathematical prediction of free energy is off from the calculated number by 10 to the 120. That is the largest mismatch in the history of science. Between science and nature and theory, one with 120 zeros after it. If you find out what this dark energy is, you will win the Nobel Prize in physics. If you find out what dark energy is, be sure to tell me first.
All right, we have a question right here.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Is there another question?
I'm going to repeat it so that it's recorded. We mentioned that there is no evidence to date to support string theory, but what would be the appropriate avenue? Where might we find some?
So the hope was that the Large Hadron Collider was going to be the place where that would happen. There's a collection of particles that string theory predicts. The full name of string theory is actually superstring theory. They're called supersymmetric particles. And no one's ever seen any of these particles. And the hope was that they would be created at the Large Hadron Collider. So far, it hasn't turned up anything, but that doesn't mean that it won't happen, although the window of possibility is closing. But that's just one possibility. There are other experimental ideas that have been put on the table. The search for the extra dimensions that we briefly mentioned that string theory requires. You can slam particles together, and possibly some of the debris from that collision can get ejected into the other dimensions, creating less energy in our accessible part of reality compared to what we had before the collision. Missing energy signatures, possibly, for extra dimensions. If you have a big string that got stretched out by cosmic expansion, normally you think about things as really tiny, but cosmic expansion might have caught up a string and stretched it as the universe expanded. And as that string vibrates through space, it gives off a collection of very iconic gravitational waves. If we were to see that pattern of gravitational waves, that would be evidence of a string vibrating in the universe. That would also be indirect evidence for this collection of ideas. So there's a whole host of things of that sort, but none of them yet have borne fruit.
I think the most probable way of being able to prove some version of string theory is through dark matter. Dark matter holds the galaxy together. We have maps of dark matter, and we're clueless, absolutely clueless at the present time as to what dark matter is. One of the leading theories of what dark matter is that it's the photino, a neutralino, that is a partner of the photon, a sparticle. A sparticle is a superparticle whose partner is light. So light's super partner is the sparticle, the photino, and it may actually make up most of the matter of the entire universe. And we have maps of dark matter. There's dark matter in this room. Our Earth is moving in a wind of dark matter. And one day, dark matter is going to hit a proton, cause it to disintegrate in a spark chamber. We'll photograph it and have concrete evidence of the existence of dark matter under semi-controlled conditions in a spark chamber. Once we identify it, catalog its properties, it may turn out to be the sparticle. And that would go a long ways to proving the existence of supersymmetry, which is the foundation of superstring theory.
So I'm someone who in 1975, when I was a graduate student at MIT, I was the first person there to take super seriously symmetry. I mean, seriously.
That's a hard one to say.
And I wrote my PhD thesis on it. So I've dedicated my entire scientific career to this idea about supersymmetry. You know, it would be, to my mind, it would be really nice if the creator actually rewarded me for this.
All right, so I think that we've got time for maybe one more question, unfortunately. And I've completely ignored this side of the room. Sorry, guys. So I would love to ask you right there.
Ask a young person.
Oh, gosh, you guys.
Get a young person.
Go ahead. All right, so the question is, are the constants that we learned about in high school and college actually constant, or have they changed kind of throughout the evolution of physics?
Nobody knows. I will leave it at that. No, people have put forward various proposals for changing constants of nature, and there has been some evidence cited, observations of distant quasars, the spectral lines, perhaps, changing in a manner that would be best explained by those constants of nature shifting their values over time. I would say that most mainstream physicists do not think that there's enough data, anywhere near enough data, to take this idea seriously yet. But it's an interesting possibility, right? I mean, most things in the universe are dynamical. Most things are able to change over time. And it's certainly possible that the things that we thought were constant may actually drift over cosmic eras. So only observation will ultimately be able to answer that question, as yet we don't have the data to come to an answer.
If things like the speed of light or the gravitational constant were to change, we would be in big trouble.
Right.
However, we welcome that possibility because it means more publications, more tenures, more Nobel Prizes, more excitement in the field. But it would tear at the fabric of the foundations of modern physics. Special relativity depends on the speed of light being a constant. In general relativity, when you take a slice of general relativity, it also depends on the speed of light being a constant. And so most of modern physics is based on having a few fundamental constants. So if it were to be disproven, all hell would break loose, and we welcome that.
But special relativity is based on the speed of light being constant in the sense that you can't change its value through the kinetics of other motion. But if you had a slowly varying speed of light, actually you'd be able to make special relativity work reasonably well.
I'll
leave it at that.
I see. Oh, okay. We've got time for more questions since we started a little late. So there was somebody who was really loud and excited back here. Wait, the person who just went, hello, how about you? You know who you are. There you go. Where are you, by the way? Are you up there? Oh, wow, you're way up there. Okay, go ahead. Whoa, whoa, wait, we're up here first. We're up here first, then we'll come back. No, it's okay. I know this is a weird system we've got going, but go ahead with the Higgs boson math.
Well, it depends who you ask. I
mean, what's right. the mass
Gordy
of the Higgs
yeah,
boson?
Gordy Kane would claim
of ours,
he, that's
yeah,
right.
he claimed of ours he did. Claims that string theory predicted its value. Yeah. Again, many of us are somewhat skeptical of the claim of that particular sort. The value that came out, though, is particularly interesting because it's right sort of at a knife-edge value, which suggests the possibility that our universe might ultimately be unstable. Which means that in the far future, our universe could do what an electron does when it encounters a barrier. It can quantum tunnel through the barrier. Our universe might be able to quantum tunnel to a lower energy state. Now, if that happened, we would definitely be in big trouble.
All right, and
we wouldn't be here.
Unfortunately, there was a biologist, so I have a soft spot, and I want to hear your question. What was that?
Unfair, but okay.
I think it's 99.9%. I mean, most of what we do is wrong. Not that we make a mistake. That's it. Sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
He said he's a biologist, so he needs to 5%.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're smarter than we are. But, you know, most of what we do is wrong because we're doing our best to muddle through and understand the universe a little bit more deeply. Well, so, you know, the hope is that what you do has some impact on a ripple effect that collectively drives us closer to truth as a community. But any individual scientist, most of what they do is not, as a theorist, I should say, is not actually going to be relevant to reality.
Well, most of what we do is right in our domain. Even Newtonian physics is right when you deal with car engines and rocket ships and stuff like that, in that domain. But physics is now going to larger and larger domains when we realize that the previous domain was too small. The domain of rocket ships and levers and pulleys of Isaac Newton does not apply to atoms, and that in turn does not apply to black holes, and perhaps that does not apply to the Big Bang itself. So most of what we know about physics is true in our particular domain, but we're constantly pushing the domains of physics.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, you know, in science, peer review is incredibly important. When you publish in a peer-reviewed journal where other individuals with the same credentials oftentimes will look at your work and determine whether or not it is legitimate and up to snuff and worthy of review. With experimental evidence, it's a little easier to do that, is it not? How does the peer review process work in theoretical physics where the math may be appropriate, the theory may be right, 100% of that might be right, but 99% of it may never pan out experimentally?
So, you know, the idea of peer review among people like us is very interesting because at some level, in some sense, we're reaching for the beginning of the universe. That's what this discussion has largely been about. And nobody really knows how to get there. So what you can do in peer review is, if Brian writes a paper and it comes across my desk to review it, the first thing I do is I'll check his math. Mm-hmm. Because if it's mathematically correct, then I get the great pleasure to say, get rid of this junk, right? But if he gets the math right, and then goes on to make some very interesting sorts of speculations, then I feel it's my duty as a referee to say, there's something very interesting here, let's let the weight of the community be brought to bear on this idea. And that's, I think that's the best you can do as a theorist.
Nice.
All right, I think we have at least another. Ooh, right here.
So we talk a lot about how we have theories like string theory explaining small particle physics and how they're not in accordance with Newtonian physics, which explains the way things move at large scale. And we're seeking a unifying theory. How would string theory really classify as that unifying theory? Like, how do we take the ideas of string theory and apply them to
So this is a question, you could ask the same question about Einstein's theory. How do you apply special relativity to getting in a taxi and going downtown? Mm. The answer is you don't. And so when you talk about unified, what you, and this word came up several times in our discussion, within its domain. So within its domain, we want a single set of mathematical ideas that are consistent across the size of something as small as the subatomic nucleus or even smaller, to the range of the size of the universe. Outside of string theory, I don't know of any piece of mathematics that looks reasonable at that task, but that doesn't mean I'm going to apply string theory to figure out how to make the Dallas Cowboys win the next game.
Well, can I just add one thing to that and chime in if you disagree? But you know, if you start with the basic equation of string theory, which there is one, which is the starting point, and if you churn the mathematics enough, you actually can extract Einstein's equations of general relativity from a starting point that has nothing to do with gravity and nothing to do with curved space-time. You're just talking about the motion of these little tiny vibrating filaments. So that, to me, provides some of the link that I felt you were looking for, right? You start with the equations of the very small, you churn away, and lo and behold, Einstein's math comes right out of it. You can imagine history of science fancifully taking place on an alien planet where they didn't find general relativity before they found string theory. And if that were the case, then they would have extracted general relativity from string theory. That's impressive. And that's part of where our belief that this is worthy of attention comes from.
Are there any more young people in the audience who have questions? Oh, I hear, okay, I'm going to go with whoever's up here because it's so bright I can't see you. Oh, wow. Can you tell me how old you are? How old are you? 10. 10-year-old question coming at us. Okay, what is it?
Whoa.
Does quantum physics and string theory, do they narrow down the different possibilities for the shape of the universe?
Mm-hmm. No. String theory says that you can get all of Einstein's theory of general relativity out of it, but string theory in turn, and Einstein's theory in turn, requires you put in data from the beginning, and that is a fudge factor. We want a theory where you don't put any fudge factors from the outside. This is called fine-tuning. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be able to fine-tune the equations. You want the equations to tell you from the very beginning, without any further assumptions, how the universe will evolve. Now, string theory predicts not just one universe, but many universes. We didn't get into this, but this is the full multiverse. Mm-hmm. We call it a landscape of many, many different kinds of universes, trillions of different kinds of universes. Our universe is among them. But then the question is, why is our universe separate or different from all the other universes? So in other words, string theory does in fact predict many universes of different curvatures. But why our universe? Why our particular universe? That is an unanswered question. And if you find out, let's publish together.
Yeah. All right, so there was another young gentleman up there in an orange puffer jacket. I see you. Can you tell me first how old you are? You're also 10 years old. Okay, and what's your question?
So, if the universe is a lot of different bubbles,
but
in
the
bubble
back,
those bubbles aren't going to last forever.
What happens when the bubble pops? Ah, that's a great question. Ah. So, if you couldn't hear it, if a universe is a bubble in a large bubble bath, and they're all kind of together, eventually those bubbles in the bubble bath are going to pop. So what happens when our universe pops?
Well, we don't like to talk about this. But as Brian pointed out, our universe may also be unstable. There could be a quantum transition. Bubbles can collide, giving you what is called the Big Splat Theory. The Big Splat Theory is when two bubbles collide to give you an even bigger bubble. Or the bubble can fission, and that's inflationary theory, okay? So there are at least two ways it could happen. Or perhaps universes can pop out of nothing, like what Larry Krauss was talking about, quantum fluctuation out of nothing. So we don't really know how stable our universe is, but our universe itself may have come out of nothing because our universe seems to have the quantum numbers of nothing. For example, what is the spin of the universe? If you add up all the spin of the galaxies, it turns out to be zero. That's compatible with the universe from nothing because the universe started with zero spin. What is the charge of the universe? Well, plus cancels against minus. Therefore, we don't feel electric field so much. It's a very fine tuning. So the net charge of the universe is zero. The universe has zero charge. The universe has zero spin, perhaps because the universe came out of nothing. In which case, there's always a probability that a Higgs boson could come along, destabilize our vacuum, and then eat us up. Now, it's not going to be pleasant. If this vacuum were to be destabilized here, it would expand at the speed of light. So there you are doing your laundry, and there's this anomaly in space-time coming at you. You wouldn't even see it coming, because the bubble would be coming at you at the speed of light. And once it hits you, your atoms of your body go into a different vacuum. Protons are no longer stable. You dissolve into a mass of subatomic particles. It's not going to be pleasant if that happens.
So, I think I'd rather go that way. I don't know.
So this idea of the universe disappearing actually shows up in many different guises. When I was in graduate school, we used to call this the fate of the false vacuum. And Michio remembers those days, so this is back in the 70s. But one of the interesting things to me about supersymmetry is that it's a set of really weird equations. It tends to dampen out quantum fluctuations. And so if supersymmetry is around, maybe it's there to make sure that we stay around.
Hmm. Brian, would you have anything to add to that?
Oh my God, no.
On that note, I really, really, really want to thank, first of all, Dr. Michio Kaku, Dr. Brian Green, Dr. Jim Gates for joining us. Everybody here for coming, for engaging, and for being a part of this discussion. And as I say on my podcast, which we've actually been recording for tonight, I'm really looking forward to the next time that we all get together to talk nerdy. Thank you, guys.